Bow for prayer. God our Father, we give thanks for those who equip us for our ministry by shedding light upon the nature of our stewardship. So we are grateful for the sharpened insight and the enlarged vision that have come to us this week through the mind and life of thy servant, Dr. Roger Shin. To those who aspire to be thy servants in a new time, give, we pray, the will to think carefully, to feel compassionately, and to venture boldly and gladly. For thou hast been our help in ages past. Thou wilt be our hope for the years to come through Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen. As we come to the fourth and final lecture of the Carver Barnes series for this year, I'm sure that you join me in saying a hearty thank you to Dr. Shin for his interesting, searching, lively, and timely discussion. His sensitive consideration of some of the vital ethical issues of our time has been a memorable example, it seems to me, of the kind of reflection that the church must do as it wrestles with problems of agonizing importance. So I would like to say, may Dr. Shin's tribe increase as young men and women of dedication and intelligence take up the gauntlet which a new era in time has flung at our feet. Dr. Shin's final lecture is entitled The Style of Christian Polemics. Dr. Shin.
Thank you, Dr. Tull. It helps to have old friends on faculties around the country where you visit, because that assures you a warm welcome, and I've surely had it here. The last 2 days, I have taken a look at two concrete areas of ethical decision where we face problems that we haven't dealt with in just the same way in the past. The problem of the new scarcities and the problems connected with genetics. This morning in this last lecture, I want in a way to return to what I was doing the first day, to come at some of the factors that affect us as we go at any ethical decision. The first day I talked about the baffling mix of confusion and guilt. Today, in somewhat the same way, but a little different way, I want to look at what enters into ethical argument, no matter what the subject might be. And so I call it the style of Christian polemics. Let's begin by looking at the reason for ethical polemics. If message has something to do with medium, if purpose influences style, then the reason for ethical polemics will affect the tone and manner. Quite obviously, the biblical ethic includes a powerful polemical strain. Granted, all the varieties within biblical ethics, rarely is the mood simply contemplative. The biblical ethic is not an ethic that centers on an interior enlightenment that rescues persons from the turmoil of history. It's not an ethic of acquiescence in things as they are. It is not an ethic of aesthetic vision that makes all suffering tolerable. It is an ethic of social transformation, of world transformation. So the Hebrew prophets are polemicists. They attack the perpetrators of injustice, especially the politically and economically powerful. Jesus of Nazareth carried on the prophetic tradition. He was a controversial character, offensive to many of his contemporaries. He was the object of polemics, and he was a polemicist. His good news was often heard as bad news. The Gospels heap up the denunciations of hypocrites. Now, perhaps the scriptural records exaggerate, as some New Testament scholars say. Do they maybe reflect the polemical situation of the early church, which treasured and preserved Jesus' biting criticisms directed against his attackers, giving them maybe an undue prominence in the tradition that got recorded in the New Testament? Perhaps so. The same records report that Jesus loved people. And you might ask, if he refused to love hypocrites, who'd there be to love? But we cannot write off all his denunciations as exaggerations of the early church. Jesus was plainly a man of controversy, who sufficiently incensed people that they crucified him. I think it was Halford Luckock who said that they crucified Jesus not because he said, "Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow," but because he said, "Consider the money changers, how they steal." So the biblical ethic is a polemical ethic. And yet it's an ethic that says much of love, mercy, forgiveness, and reconciliation. Because it is reconciling in purpose, it is often polemical in practice. It might be called an irenic polemic, words that derive from the Greek words for peace and war, irene and polemos. Because of concern for persons, it is impatient with injustice and deceptive rhetoric. Because of faith in God, it's contemptuous of idols. Because of concern for truth, it must unmask hidden error. There are thus sound reasons why any ethic in the biblical tradition will in some manner combine irenic and polemic styles. But that does not necessarily tell us why we, the human beings that we are, engage in polemics and irenics. There are biblical reasons and theological reasons, but there are also some other very human reasons. And the ethical validity of the mix between irenic and polemic may depend less on the ratio between the two. I suspect that's likely to vary among us, depending upon our vocations and gifts, than upon the reasons and the motives behind either. The polemic against evil, for example, may be an act of Christian faithfulness. And the avoidance of polemics may be prompted by timidity, profit, or indolence. The desire to avoid trouble and the desire to please are humanly common. They may tempt us to smooth over controversy and take the easy way. The prophet Jeremiah assails the false prophets who despise the word of the Lord. They say, "Peace, peace," when there is no peace. They say, "It shall be well with you, and no evil shall come upon you." And they say that not out of faithfulness, but because they're false prophets. Now, temptations like that are common in most varieties of religious ethics and in Christian ethics today. The church is a voluntary organization. Its strength and prosperity seem to depend greatly upon the popularity of its leaders. These leaders are reluctant to offend people. So sometimes they avoid polemics, even when faithfulness requires a polemic message. However, those of us who enjoy controversy must reckon with another possibility. Polemics do not always express faithfulness. Sometimes they express insecurity. When we're most uncertain of ourselves, we're most likely to judge and condemn others. Am I unsure that I'm right? Well, I can at least shout that somebody else is wrong. Am I unsure that I love? I can at least denounce haters. So as I listen to Christian ethical talk, whether preaching or formal pronouncements or conversation, I find myself bothered both by timid ingratiation and by censorious judgments. The timidity comes from a fearfulness to be forthright, lest somebody be offended, from a pathetic eagerness to please, and it's such a spirit that has led to the description of too many Christian leaders as the bland leading the bland. And I don't mean Tom Bland. But the freewheeling condemnations of energetic Christians can be just as disturbing. Did you ever hear the courageous sermon and suspect that it was the fearful talk of the preacher who didn't dare answer his wife and hence tells off the congregation? The dogmatic remark in conversation often comes from somebody who lacks the confidence that would enable him to grant that there are other ways of looking at the subject. So as I go about my business, I meet these same problems in myself. I know the temptation to keep quiet, to avoid trouble, to take care not to antagonize people who matter. Now, true, we in academic vocations sometimes feel superior to pastors who fear to antagonize powerful parishioners. But that's not our courage. That's simply the arrogance of those who are a little more insulated from the threats that pastors feel. Professors are more likely to knuckle under to the judgment of their peers or sometimes their students. We all have what the sociologists call our reference groups, whose approval we seek. On the other hand, I also know the temptation of gloating over putting the enemy to rout and counting my scalps after a battle. In some fights, where in retrospect I'm most sure my cause was right, I still know I got too much delight out of humiliating the opposition. I hope that God does not begrudge me all the joy of combat. I believe he wants me to be a warrior and would rather I be a happy warrior than a crabbed warrior. But I don't think he approves my joy in inflicting pain, my uncharitable judgments on my enemies. I'm not proud of all my polemical career. Now, notice, I did not say that I'm not at all proud of my polemical career, but that I'm not proud of all of it. And so this means that as we consider polemics, we must pay some attention to our motives. It's not enough to ask, are we too eager in running toward or running away from fights? We must also ask, why are we running as we are? And then we examine our motives. And of course, we find that they are not pure. No matter what we do it partly for the wrong reasons. In Pasternak's novel, Dr. Zhivago comes to a point in his self-interrogation. He's trying to decide what to do, and he realizes if I do it for this reason, if I do this, it'll be partly for the wrong reason. But if I do this, it'll be partly for the wrong reason. He learns he can't entirely trust his own motives, so he gets the point, he just says, damn all motives, I'm going to get on with the job. I'm going to do what I think's best. Now, there's a wisdom in that style of action, but not too fast. Not until we have interrogated ourselves and come to some self-understanding. And then We must look at the objective situation and make the best choices we can. We'll never purify ourselves totally by introspection. We have to act. Now, to take another step requires a few observations about the nature of ethical argument. In most ethical arguments, I'd say in all ethical arguments except the most abstract and formal, there is an empirical and more or less scientific component. That is, when we get an ethical discussion, especially as it affects any policy decision, part of what we're discussing is information. To take the most spectacular recent example, some arguments about the ethics of the Nixon administration were settled by the empirical evidence of tape recordings. The data became incontestable, and the data all but dictated certain ethical conclusions. If we look at the arguments that Christians engage in as they ponder the ethics of certain courses of action, we find repeatedly that empirical data and scientific conceptual schemes are essential to ethical judgments. How much risk is there in a projected medical experiment? You've got to learn the facts. Does school busing improve the performance of some, none, or all participants? You want the evidence. Is the affluent lifestyle and the growth of population, as I argued yesterday, pushing the earth to the limits of its capacity? You need the evidence. Can nuclear energy become functional without perilous radioactive wastes? You need the data. What's the relation between full employment and inflation? What will be the economic and human effect of a tax reduction or of a special tax on petroleum? Here you're trying to learn information and processes that scientific data and reasoning can tell you something about. And questions like those are, in principle, resolvable by scientific methods. Now, some of them go beyond the capacity of our present science to solve, but on that kind of question, we're not likely to do better by quoting sacred scriptures or rousing polemical fervor. Furthermore, answers to those questions go a long way toward resolving ethical controversies, but not all the way, because some questions remain about human goals and values. Empirical data and scientific conceptual models help us make ethical decisions, but do not determine the meaning of human life. On those issues where there's a wide consensus about values, then scientific reason can go a long way toward prescribing desirable programs of action. There we don't have to get angry with each other in our arguments. We simply search out the evidence. Now, another element in ethical argument is value clarification. And here we come closer to fundamental human commitments. But even here, there's a place for some cool reasoning. For example, what is the responsibility of citizens to obey laws? The common rhetoric is often not meant seriously at all. A law and order administration may suddenly be revealed as contemptuous of law. Or law-defying radicals may become legalists in holding their opponents responsible to law. Now here, ethical discussion can work toward clarity of convictions about responsibility of people to obey or disobey laws. It can work on criteria for determining which occasions call for obedience and which for disobedience. and such discussion might be cool, reasonable, and non-polemical. I say it might be non-polemical, because in practice, it's likely to be polemical. And the reason is that the very effort at clarification drives people to fundamental questions about their convictions and motivations. And then you're touching sore spots. It often shows the discrepancy between rhetoric and practice, the deception that people practice on themselves and each other, and the corruption of values by self-interest. Questions of guilt arise, and prophetic polemics may address the situation. Ethical conflict always takes place in social contexts. And here, to repeat a point I mentioned yesterday, there are real conflicts of interest and usually conflicts of fundamental values. Now, on a highly abstract level, there may be wide consensus. Most of mankind would probably agree that generosity is nobler than greed, honesty better than deception, love more beautiful than cruelty, sharing better than domination. But that's pretty abstract. Read a little of Marx and Nietzsche, just to take a couple of very different examples, and you see how hollow much of the agreement is. When people enter into ethical conflict in concrete situations, then that generalized rhetoric either gives way to specific conflicting claims, or the rhetoric becomes a weapon in the warfare over the claims. And then the style of debate quickly becomes polemical. Most public debate on important issues takes place in the realm where facts are confused, something I talked about Tuesday. Basic commitments are confused, and even more, the relationship between facts and commitments is confused. And precisely for those reasons, and also for the reason that so much is at stake in such debates, they deserve our attention. If that is a little bit confusing, let me give you an example that I think will make it straight. This comes from a former student of mine, Daniel D. McCracken, was a computer specialist. He became chairman of an organization called the Computer Specialists Against the ABM, the anti-ballistic missile. In 1967, a Senate committee was investigating this missile. The committee had the rather long name, the Senate Subcommittee on International Organization and Disarmament Affairs of the Committee on Foreign Relations. Now, the anti-ballistic missile had been endorsed by the Department of Defense. In the arguments, a question rose as to whether the computer technology built into the system would work. Now, there's probably not a person in this room, I say probably because I don't know, there's probably not a person in this room who's qualified to judge whether the computer technology in an ABM will work or not. There's nothing in the usual training of a theologian or an ethicist, or, as the hearing showed, of a United States senator, that gives competence in evaluating the technological feasibility of computing mechanisms within a weapons system. Who knows about this? Why, specialists in computers have the training to make such judgments. And so it turned out, the Defense Department produced a list of specialists who vouched for the technological adequacy of the ABM system. But a considerable number of scientists and computer specialists said it would not work. And what are the senators to do? Well, Senator Fulbright noted one common characteristic of all the scientists who testified that the system would work. And it was not that they'd all gone to Harvard or MIT or anything like that. it was that they were all, I'm quoting Senator Fulbright now, they were all employees of or persons closely related to the Pentagon. Those who said it wouldn't work were a much more diverse group, but among them, those who went to the trouble of speaking out were, to a noticeable extent, scientists who also had moral and political objections to the ABM. Now, a non-specialist like me, looking at the evidence, is bound to guess that the technical judgments were not in every case purely technical judgments, but had something to do with the interests or commitments of the scientists involved. But when Senator Fulbright asked Assistant Secretary of Defense David Packard whether he had consulted independent scientists, Mr. Packard replied, "Senator Fulbright, I do not consider that when you are involved with scientific matters, it is important whether you have people outside the Defense Department or not. Scientists, to me, are objective about such matters." Well, that kind of remark prompts some reflections on the nature of objectivity. Certainly, there is some kind of objectivity in processes of scientific verification. That is, scientists do change their minds and recast their theories on the basis of unexpected evidence. Presumably, a total pacifist might judge that a military technology would work, even though he opposed using it. And presumably, a militant scientist might judge a technology impractical, even though or even because he wanted to maximize his country's military potential. Presumably, such objectivity is possible. But in complex cases, like the one Senator Fulbright's committee was hearing, it turns out the correlation between technological judgments and ethical political positions is too close to persuade the outsider that scientific empiricism is entirely objective. On one occasion, I was presenting this case study to a group of people, and a military officer present expressed his amazement that a distinguished theologian, when he said that, I knew he was getting ready to put in the knife, would resort to the fallacious argument ad hominem. Now, all the logic textbooks teach that you don't refute the logic of an argument by saying there's something wrong with the person who presents it. But now what we know about the relation between personal character and perception requires us to reconsider that ancient fallacy. Certainly the logic books are right to a point. We cannot refute the genius of a mathematician by arguing that she's cruel to her children. We cannot deny the brilliance of an actor because of his offstage sexual capers. But anybody might wisely question the advice of an investment counselor who'd been through two or three bankruptcies, or of a marital counselor who'd driven three successive spouses to suicide. You see, at some point, in some way, the argument ad hominem makes some kind of sense. That is, there is some relation between people's competence and their personal and social lives. To define that relation is not at all easy. I've said that much of what we ordinarily consider ethical argument is in fact arguments about data or conceptualizations that have an independence of the opinions of arguers. Yet the data and conceptualizations that people can entertain depend in part upon their social situation, their experiences, their prejudices and commitments. To refute an argument where ethics impinges on policy It is sometimes enough to talk non-polemically, just to say to another person, look, here's some evidence and logic that will guide you to a different decision. But sometimes it's necessary to say polemically, you have misread the situation because of a moral stubbornness or a lack of imagination. The facts are there, you just can't see them. My point is, in a way, a very old one. Serious moral argument, at least from the time of the Hebrew prophets and Socrates, has taken into account the importance of understanding not only the statements made in controversy, but the motives that lead to the statements. Tuesday, I tried to show how contemporary psychology, using as my example some work of Gordon Allport, had on empirical grounds sort of rediscovered what Jesus had said about how some people have eyes and cannot see and have ears and cannot hear. Today, I want to do the same thing in a little different way. I want to say that in the 19th and 20th centuries, we have rediscovered what the prophets and the New Testament were saying in the course of certain other kinds of study that were new in the 19th and 20th century. And I'll mention some pioneers in this study, controversial people whom maybe we all disagree with on some points, but ought to be able to learn from on other points. Karl Marx, for example, emphasized the way in which people's social situations influence their apprehension of the world. Poor people see the world differently from rich people. Some arguments, said Marx, and some acts proceed from a false consciousness or an ideology that functions to protect position and power. Sigmund Freud showed how much of the seemingly rational is a veneer over the turbulent, buried desires of people. Jean-Paul Sartre exposed the bad faith that often shapes people's attitudes, beliefs, and acts. Now, in such cases, there is something futile and misleading about an intellectual skirmish that touches only on the decorations of a moral argument. What point is there in correcting the factual details of a position if the whole position is the expression of false consciousness or bad faith? Then the only effective attack is on the falsity of the whole consciousness that produces the argument, or very often on the social situation that produces the false consciousness. Taking a clue from Marx, a variety of 20th century thinkers have done sophisticated work in the sociology of knowledge. I'll mention only one of them, Karl Mannheim, who has shown what the sociology of knowledge means for controversy in the sphere of political ethics. Political argument, says Mannheim, grows largely from social situational roots and takes ideological forms. If the function of ideology, Mannheim here follows Marx, if the function of ideology is to conceal the actual meaning of conduct rather than to reveal it, then conventional forms of argumentation are almost useless. And what you have to do, says Mannheim, is the tearing off of disguises. In that kind of an argument, it's not enough to tell the opponent that there are facts he hasn't taken into account. You have to say, given the disguises you're maintaining, you're unwilling to listen to those facts. And in such a setting, political discussion, in Mannheim's words, seeks not only to be in the right, but also to demolish the basis of its opponent's social and intellectual existence. Now that is tough language. Let me read it again. To demolish the basis of the opponent's social and intellectual existence. You'd rather not go that far. But if my name's right, you might have to. I say it's tough language. It's close to the language of war. The target is no longer simply the adequacy of evidence or the soundness of judgment of others. The aim, I repeat Mannheim's words, is to demolish the basis of the opponent's social and intellectual existence. I say we'd usually rather not do that. But there are situations that call for such polemic or such activity. Any of us could think of a few spectacular examples in recent and contemporary history, then could probably add a few from more intimate experience. What sense is there, when addressing perpetrators of genocide, in telling them there are a few anthropological facts that are different from what you think, or some political values you ought to take into account? Does that make any sense when somebody's practicing genocide? How can victims enter into rational discussion with oppressors prior to some change in the whole situation? When arguments are designed, again I use Mannheim's words, to conceal the actual meaning of conduct rather than to reveal it, how can discussion move ahead without the tearing off of disguises? But to enter such a stage of polemics means to discard most of the hopes characteristic of parliamentary democracy. And it usually means a dehumanizing of the opposition. Societies recoil with reason from that step. This is why we develop such elaborate formalities of discourse to maintain some amenities. In senatorial courtesy, people speak of my distinguished colleague, even if they really mean that cheating scoundrel who owes his office to the crooks that bought his way into it. William Buckley, who sometimes gets off a clever comment in the midst of many foolish ones, says that after he'd spent some time in the United Nations and got conditioned to its language, he found himself referring to my distinguished Cocker Spaniel. As a fundamental rule of senatorial courtesy is to avoid attacking motives. But when motives are corrupt, can there be authentic argument that pretends they aren't? The forms of parliamentary discourse have their farcical and hypocritical aspects, but they're laboriously contrived as a shield against chaos. When argument moves from the merits of the case to the motives of the participants, it's endless, and sooner or later everybody's vulnerable. So we try to avoid that. Nevertheless, we live in an era when the tendency is strong to move from challenging the argument to challenging its proponent. One reason, emphasized by Mannheim, is just the general turbulence of our history and the diminishing authority of traditional patterns of ethical and political judgment. But another is the necessity for all of us to make many judgments on areas outside our technical competence. I, for example, do not pretend to know enough to judge the adequacy of computer technologies. But when the experts differ, I know enough to question the objectivity of those hired by the Pentagon. I don't know enough biochemistry to make a sound judgment about the relation between cigarette smoking and cancer or heart disease. But I know enough to be skeptical about the experts hired by the tobacco companies. I don't know enough economics to set wisely the discount rate for the Federal Reserve System. I think I know enough to wonder about the credentials and objectivity of people who set the rates or of those who appoint them. Now, all of us, you see, day in and day out, are making decisions, or avoiding decisions, which is the same thing, beyond the bounds of our competence. beyond the bounds of our expertise. But all people in our society have at least a little competence in the sociology of knowledge, even though they've never heard of the term, as in investigating the credentials and the good faith of people who make the arguments. Now, I say everybody has a little skill at this. Sometimes it surfaces in kind of humorous ways. Truman Douglas, one of the eminent leaders of Protestantism in the generation just past, used to tell an anecdote to this point. Walking from his office to his home, he usually went through Union Square, which in those days, more than these latter degenerate days, was a center for political argument among small clusters of people. It was going on all the time. And occasionally on the way home, he'd join a circle and listen a while or even enter into the argument. One day, a speaker was going on pretty dogmatically, and Truman Douglas offered an argument that, in his judgment, quite refuted the speaker. The speaker wasn't bothered in the least. He looked at his audience, he pointed to Truman Douglas, and he said, don't pay any attention to him, he's carrying a briefcase. Now, to most of us who carry briefcases, that reply may seem totally irrelevant to the issue of the argument. But who knows for sure? Probably we can imagine situations in which that reply would be relevant. Now, I've been discussing the sociology of knowledge. I've also been discussing ethics, I think theological ethics. But it's time to be more explicit on that point. I've been assuming some notions of how people feel and think as they make ethical arguments. And I've supported these ideas with reference to Mannheim and some other recent thinkers. But I believe these arguments are basically consistent with a biblical anthropology. In biblical anthropology, people are never simply detached intellects. They think not only with their minds, but with their hearts and their bowels. Furthermore, they're never simply individuals. They're formed by communities with histories. And their histories, or we might say their social situations, determine or influence what they're able to perceive and what they insist on repressing. Hence, ethical judgment is profoundly related to historical situation. In the Bible, an enslaved people can see what is hidden to Pharaoh. In my career, black people can sometimes see what has been hidden to white people. Back to the Bible, the vain imagination is a deceptive imagination. There is a wisdom revealed to some, but hidden to the rulers of this age. And so argument, especially ethical argument, is never purely empirical rational in an objective sense. It's related to historical situations and the interests and sensitivities of people involved. In their combination of ignorance and perversity, people act deceitfully. And it's not just that they know the truth and deliberately lie about it, though of course that can happen. More often, their deception of others is caused by their deception of themselves. Their errors are not just the errors of creaturely fallible beings. They are, to repeat Tuesday's theme, the errors of guilty beings. Now, all this, I think, tells us something about the dynamics of Christian ethical polemics. There is a dynamic for Christian polemics. I've pointed to the prominence of polemics in Hebrew prophecy and the sayings of Jesus. The world hasn't improved so greatly that the call for polemics is obsolete. Evil still masquerades as good. Hate wears the garments of virtue. Privilege assumes the guise of justice. And often enough, the ecclesiastical and academic world don't notice. They evade the responsibility for polemic. An ethical polemic will unveil those evils, tear down their ideological pretenses, let the truth stand out. It'll lead to action, opposition to evil. It requires moral courage and endurance. That's the dynamic for Christian polemics. But there is, second, a dynamic for Christian restraint in polemics. I'm not talking about the inertia or timidity of restraint, but the dynamic of restraint. One reason is that not every argument over the ethics of policy decision has to be a mutual accusation. It's possible for people of goodwill to disagree in their judgments. And then they don't need polemics against each other. They need mutual questioning, discussion, enlightenment of each other. And on many an ethical issue before us, we don't know for sure what the best answer is. And so we better compare our hunches with those of other people and not immediately denounce everybody that disagrees with us. Often, honest, friendly debate is better than attacking the motives and character of other people. But there are times when moral arguments are so related to our hypocrisies, our pretending, our whole set of personal interests masquerading as good, that only a polemical tearing away of the disguises will make any difference. And at that point, committed people will feel a responsibility not just to exchange views, but to denounce evil and to denounce the arguments of advocates of evil. Now, this is never going to be a simple situation. Often, the opposing factions on both sides will claim a moral responsibility to denounce each other. And I don't expect that to change. But some of us, from time to time, are going to feel obliged to say of policies or actions, not simply that we think they're misguided, but that we think they are morally wrong, cruel, or oppressive. And then if we're silent, the reason will be cowardice. But even then, there's still a dynamic of restraint. Even as we accuse the opposition, we'd better recognize that we are not entirely righteous. And just then, we may most need to heed the word of Jesus, "Judge not that you be not judged. For with the judgment you pronounce, you will be judged, and the measure you give will be the measure you get." Now, I don't want to be sentimental on this. There is a kind of driveling masochism that does nobody any good. The Jews slaughtered by Hitler were not guilty of genocide. And you don't have to make the case that they were perfect people, as of course nobody is, to say that they had a righteous objection to cruelty. The black people oppressed in South Africa and in this country are not perfect people, but they're not exercising massive tyranny. I, on occasion, have refused to repeat liturgical confessions in which I was supposed to bemoan my guilt for public policies that I'd spent a considerable energy opposing. It might be said there was always more I could have done, but I'm not always going to crawl because I'm not a moral giant. Sometimes I have a right, I think, and a duty to denounce wrongdoers. But granting all this, the perils of moral polemics are real. Denouncing hypocrisy, I recognize myself as a hypocrite. Attacking complacency, I know how relaxed I am about wrongs that don't come close to me. Criticizing self-righteousness, I build up in myself a wonderfully righteous feeling. And I'm convicted by the Apostle Paul saying, "Therefore you have no excuse, O man, whoever you are, when you judge another. For in passing judgment upon him, you condemn yourself, because you, the judge, are doing the same things. There are special perils for those of us who know enough scripture and doctrine to talk glibly about these problems. We're likely to think that if we moan enough about our own sin and lacerate ourselves for our guilt, we earn the right to judge others. We resemble Albert Camus' Judge Penitent, who tormented himself in his guilt, thereby earning the right to accuse others. He said, "The more I accuse myself, the more I have a right to judge you." The same man spoke more wisely when he noted how often Christians judge and smite each other in the name of one who said, "Neither do I condemn you." Now, I'm not in these warnings rejecting the dynamic of polemics. I'm recognizing a comparable dynamic of grace. The influence of such grace will not be to make our polemics mild and ineffectual, but to raise them to a more penetrating and compassionate style. It may even make them more effective. If a purpose of polemics is the tearing off of disguises, we have some evidence that the effect of direct moral assault is often the hardening of disguises. People will seldom drop their disguises so long as they think they need them. They're not going to drop them as long as they're comfortable with them. That's why you have to needle them. But they're not likely to drop them when they're uptight and need them all the more. People in therapy are more likely to drop disguises than defendants in court. Even though therapy is often painful, and therapists are sometimes perceived as prosecutors. A polemic with compassion may be more effective than either non-polemical lethargy or spiteful polemic. I say it may be because we're rarely sure. And although we have some ethical responsibility to take account of the probable effectiveness of our acts, we can never know for certain the effects. So whatever the practical effectiveness, the notion of a polemic with compassion is consistent with the theological conviction that judgment and grace are not total opposites, that there is a judgment in grace and a grace in judgment. An appropriate ethical response, then, at least on occasion, is to engage in an irenic polemic. In coming to the end of these Carver Barn lectures for 1975, I want to thank Southeastern for the cordiality with which it's greeted me. I want to thank especially Dr. Lally, my host, Dr. Rogers, many of you on the faculty who've been so kind to me, the many students who've listened to me, who came to the discussion Tuesday afternoon, who questioned me in Dr. Bland's class yesterday. All of you have done much to make this an unforgettable occasion for me. And I wish you well and pray you every success in your work of education and ministry.